I'd like to thank all the organisers for the opportunity to spend some time here and to give this talk. And what I'm going to talk about today is some joint work with Corrado Mattia in Rome. And it sort of grew out of work that each of us had done separately on travelling front solutions. So basically he had worked on the hyperbolic problem and I had worked on the parabolic problem. And then we did some things together. Okay, so. Okay, so this is what I'm going to talk about, right? These two equations at the top of the screen. So this is the hyperbolic equation and this is the parabolic equation. And I'll come back to this later, but we're going to take G, the source term, to be a C choose Z, but as smooth as you want, basically. And to have two zeros, one at zero and one at one, to be negative in between, and I also suppose that it has simple zeros at zero and one. But that's to do with the existence of hyperbolic transformation. Okay, so you might not like the fact that it's negative, but I'll make the remark now that you can flip everything by a change of variables, right? I mean, you can certainly make a change of variables to what I considering, I don't know, say positive G with decreasing fronts instead of increasing fronts and negative. Okay, so if you don't like the particular results that I give, then you can make a whole class of change of variables that turns them into something else. Okay, so this is sometimes, particularly in parabolic literature, called a monostable nonlinearity, right? And that's just because if you look at the linear problem, then one of these is unstable and one of them is stable. Right? Okay, and if you flip this the other way up, then this looks a bit like the basic u times 1 minus u nonlinearity that was considered by Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, and Pisman. And the type of results that you get for the existence of travelling fronts is similar to what you get in that case. But I mean, I'll come back to this much more precisely in a minute. Okay, what's a bit more interesting maybe is the flux term. Now, the key point here is that the flux is not necessarily convex. In fact, it can have a finite number of points of inflection. Now, from the point of view of the parabolic problem, I don't care whether it's convex or not. But from the point of view of the hyperbolic problem, it's much easier to analyze when the flux is convex, which I'll also come back to in a second. Right? So part of the novelty of Corrado's work about proving the existence of traveling fronts was to do with the fact that he treated a flux term which had an arbitrary number of a finite arbitrary number of points of inflection. Okay, so this is just sort of a general introduction. And what we're interested in are monotone travelling wave solutions. Okay, so we're looking for solutions u of x and t, which are a function phi of the fixed coordinate x minus ct, where c is the wave speed. And I'll suppose that phi is an increasing function, converges to naught as psi tends to minus infinity, and one of psi tends to plus infinity. And these are the two equilibria on G. Okay, so sometimes the hyperbolic problem can be considered as a simplified version of a parabolic problem. So not naturally in a physical system, you would expect there to be a small amount of viscosity present. And so if you have a solution of the hyperbolic problem, then you would like to know that it is the limit in some sense of solutions of the parabolic problem where you have a small amount of viscosity, right? Where you have some small epsilon times a uxx. So this is commonly studied and is sort of a vanishing viscosity admissibility condition. So what we would like to know more precisely, probably this is quite vague actually, but we would like to know that if we're given some travelling front solution of this hyperbolic problem, then does there exist a family of travelling fronts of the parabolic problem with speeds c epsilon such that if epsilon tends to zero, the speeds converge and the profiles converge in some sense? And in fact, as you can see from the blue box, I'm actually only going to talk about the speeds. It would be nice to talk about the profiles, but so far this is what we're doing. Okay? And I should remark for people that know all about hyperbolic problems that, of course, if I didn't have a G of U term, then the speed would be uniquely determined, right? And in that case, I could expect, and in fact we come to this later because we need it in some kind of technical context, in that case, without a source term, we could expect that we could just take C epsilon to be C. Right? But in the presence of a source term, we can't expect that, and we'll also see that it's not true. Right? That you need to allow the space of the solution of the parabolic problem to depend on it. Okay, so now I'm just going to give a very potted background, and I could spend a long time talking about background, but I'm just going to pinpoint a very few things, just to give some kind of context. So in particular, this issue to do with whether or not the flux term F is convex. So this is an issue, well, at least for what I'm interested in, this is an issue entirely for the hyperbolic problem, right? Now, if you're looking at the hyperbolic problem, then if the flux is convex, and you look at characteristics, so if you look at solutions, curves in the xt plane for dx by dt is f prime of u, and du by dt is equal to g, then if the flux is convex, I mean, this is a bit vague, but it's just to give you some flavor for why it's an issue, then if f prime is increasing in u, then you have some ordering property of the propagation speed on the characteristic curve. And this makes it much easier to study the hyperbolic problem in the case where the flux function is convex. An existing work on the connection between the two equations, when in the context of traveling fronts, let's say, is entirely in the case where there is a convex flux function. So the most relevant papers are by Jörg Hertrich, where he shows convergence of both the speeds and profiles in L1 under various conditions in the case where you have a convex flux function. The other paper is slightly less connected but interesting nonetheless, where Fan and Hale in 95 compared attractors of a hyperbolic and parabolic problem with periodic initial data. And they find that in the attractor, in the hyperbolic case, I think, consists of equilibria plus traveling wave solution. Okay. So this is basically a very potted background. And what can happen if flux is not convex? This, again, is not directly related to what we're going to do, but it just gives some context. So if the flux is not convex, then we need some new ideas to analyze the problem, because we don't have this ordering property that we have over here. But not only do you need new ideas to analyze it, but also qualitatively different things can actually happen. Right? So this is just one example. If the flux is convex, then it's been known for a long time, from Fermat's 77, for example, that if you a discontinuity forms, then it must persist for all time thereafter. It might get smaller, but it will still persist as a discontinuity. Whereas if F, in fact, this is also true, I think, if F has one inflection point, but it can be shown that there are examples where F has two or more inflection points, that the solution of the initial value problem may be discontinuous until some finite time and then be continuous thereafter. Right? And I'm not going to say anything more about that. It's something to do with the interaction between the source term and the non-convex flux term. But this doesn't happen in the case where you have a convex. And there are two papers I know of on this, one by Sinistrati in 97, another one by Corrado in 1998. Okay, and this is just the remark that I made before, that for the parabolic problem, I just don't care at all whether the flux is convex, at least for the traveling fronts that I'm interested in. Okay, now this is my only sort of modeling type slide, but I mean, the background for this, or the motivation was really theoretical, to see what would happen in the case where we had non-convex flux. But for a talk, I thought it would be nice to at least find an example where one had a non-convex flux. So I looked up a book, and this was, I think, the nicest one that I found. Okay, so this is just to give some kind of motivation from a physical point of view. So this is a model, which I found in this book here by Beck, for some two-phase fluid. So in a porous medium. So my understanding of this is basically that you can think of extracting oil, and if you take a certain amount of oil out, then you can push water in to pump more oil out. Right? And one way of modeling flux in this case, if I take U to be the saturation of water, then the flux, the derivative of flux will be small when it's mainly in one phase, because then somehow the phase, the either the water sticks to the pores or the oil sticks to the pores. And then you get some flux like that looks like this, that's definitely not complete. Right? And then you model this by an equation of this type. And this is a bit vague, but you could put in some source term if you had some chemical reactions happening at the same time. I'm not claiming this is the motivation for what we did, but I just wanted to give something. There were a couple of other examples that I felt didn't fit quite so well with what I wanted to say. And one of them was sort of a traffic flow example, which is not convex, but it is concave, right? So you could just do a flip, right? I mean, here it kind of, it goes back to zero, basically, because when the cars go bumper to bumper, it goes to zero. Right, and there is a nice example from semiconductors about a property called the gun effect, which is a very non-convex flux. Unfortunately, they're interested in oscillatory solutions, and so I felt it wasn't particularly relevant, given that I'm wanting to talk about monotone flux. Okay, but these things do arise in practice. Okay, so now that's all for the background. So let's recap. For a moment, just on the hypothesis, just to clarify. So this is just what I said before, right? G is smooth, in fact, C2 is enough. G of 0 and G of 1 are 0, they're simple zeros, and G is 0 in between, negative in between. I suppose that F is smooth, in fact, C1 plus alpha is enough for F. And I suppose I have a finite number of turning points and points of inflection. Okay. That's that. So now I have to say more precisely what I mean by traveling flux. Okay, so traveling fronts are just solutions uxt for is a function of phi of x minus ct. I suppose the profile is increasing and converges to 1 and 0. Okay, so for the parabolic problem, phi can just be taken as a c2 function. And if you substitute the ansatz, then you get a solution, a classical solution of this equation. For the hyperbolic problem, and we'll suppose that we have a piecewise smooth entropy solution. Okay, so typically for the hyperbolic problem, you have non-uniqueness, and you want to impose some kind of extra conditions to extract a unique solution. That's for the initial value problem. But when we're looking for traveling waves, we also want to impose to satisfy some kind of entropy condition at any jump. Okay, so what do we have? Well, basically we have that it's piecewise smooth. So it's C1, except at a finite number of points. Where it is C1, it satisfies this ODE. And at the jump points, first of all, it satisfies the Rankine-Fragonio condition, which is just a jump condition that guarantees that it's a weak solution. And then we suppose that it satisfies this Olenek entropy condition. Now, you don't really have to read that, because basically, this is what it means in our case. Okay, so this is just a jump condition. And the two conditions together mean this, right? It means that if I have phi, and phi L is the limit from the left, and phi R is the limit from the right, like this. Basically, phi R is the limit from the right, phi L is the limit from the left, right? Then, if I look on the flux curve, at the chord joining phi L to F of phi L and phi R to F of phi R, then the Rankine-Fragonio condition says that the speed has to be this ratio, right? So the speed has to be the slope of the curve. And what the Olenek condition, if you actually just work out what this means, says is that it has to jump below the curve if you have an upwards jump. If you have a downwards jump, it has to go above the curve, right? That's what this inequality says. So you can basically forget this and look at this. Okay, so this just gives a single jump. So this is what we mean by traveling wave solutions for these two types. Okay, so here, so in order to compare the two problems, I first of all need to tell you about known existence results for traveling fronts for each of the two problems. So this is basically what started the work in a sense, and this was a result of Corrado on existence Let me just move this up so you can see the picture. This is Existence of Travelling Fronts with a Hyperbolic Case. Right. So this was published in 1999 and is for hyperbolic problems with the source and flux term as before. And here you get an existence result, which is very similar in flavour. Maybe I should just put it in French. Which is very similar in flavour to what's known for the parabolic problem and has been known for a long time for the parabolic problem. Okay. So in the parabolic case, with a monostable nonlinearity of that, or some monostable source term of that type, then you typically get existence of travelling fronts for a half line of velocity, right, for all c bigger than or equal to some critical value. What Corrado showed was that this happens also in the hyperbolic case. Right? So what he shows, what he finds in the hyperbolic case, is that there are travelling front solutions in that entropy sense for all c bigger than or equal to this minimal value, where you notice that the minimal value depends only on f and not on g. Right? G is the source term, we suppose it is negative in between 0 and 1, but there's no dependence of G in the minimum value. In addition, if the fronts are of speed bigger than the largest value of F prime of S, where S is between 0 and 1, then the fronts are in fact smooth. Right? And this number is bigger than this number, right? Just by the new value. Okay, so this is what happens if you have some speed between this number, which may be equal in a given context. And if you have C sufficiently large, then you get something like this. Okay? Right, so okay, so I'm just going to put up, and this is not a proof. This is just sort of a justification, just for a moment, about what happens, I mean, why that is the case. Because it's pretty clear that if you take C bigger than the largest value of F prime, then this object is bounded away from zero. Right? F prime of phi minus C is bounded away from zero. Right? So if I take some arbitrary initial data, then which is between 0 and 1, then I can just get local uniqueness from this equation. This is negative, so this is positive, and then nothing bad can happen. And the existence continues to infinity. That's roughly why, if you have C bigger than this maximum, then you get smooth solution. In the other case, and this is, I mean, the proof is quite long actually, very, very roughly what happens is that if in some parts you get existence in the same way as before, but if you hit a point where F prime is equal to the speed that you're looking for, then you jump instead. Right? And again, the slope is the speed and you have to jump below the curve. And it turns out that for this range of speeds, you basically get what you basically get where you want to go by jumping below the curve. Right? If C was too small, then you would basically undershoot. And that's very, very vague. That's not really how you prove it, but that's sort of what's happening. Okay. So let's go for a moment to the parabolic problem. Okay, so as I said, this goes back to the sort of classic paper of Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, and Pistonov in 1937, and lots of other people actually, but certainly the family of Bolpert did work on this kind of result for systems, and I did something for nonlinear gradient dependent systems. But here we're just looking at a scalar equation. So what do we need to notice? Well, again, we have a half-line of velocities. And then for this parabolic problem, we can characterize the minimal velocity by this variational form. Right? So the minimal velocity is basically the infimum over all smooth functions which increase from 0 to 1 of the largest value of this ratio. Right? Now, I'm going to give you a small justification of that in a moment. But, I mean, you can see that if you actually had a monotone travelling wave increasing from 0 to 1, and you plug this into here, then you would get the speed of it back out. So you certainly can't have any travelling waves which are less than this one. right? Because if you had a travelling front, then it would give you this value. You're kind of travelling waves, but they make your symmetry. Okay, so they're always smooth in this case, and where do you get this minimal value from? Okay, there are different ways of arguing this, but this is just one of them. If I took some c which was bigger than this value, then because this is the infimum, there is an increasing function where this ratio is less than c. Right? I mean, this thing here is the smallest that this ratio can take over all monotone functions. If I take something bigger than it, then there must be a monotone function where you get this ratio less than that value of c. If you rearrange that, you get this, which tells you that rho is a substitution for the parabolic equation with that velocity. Okay, and then there's sort of, well, typically you can show that if you have a substitution and a supersolution, you can find a solution in between. So we need a supersolution, and you might think that you can just take the solution one to be your supersolution, but that doesn't work because you can't take a supersolution that's actually a solution. So you have to take something a little bit less, so you restrict to a half line, look on the half line, prove existence on the half line, and take a limit. Okay? And I'm just showing you this because in what we're about to do, this formula is very important. And so it may be nice to have some feeling for very clearly. Okay, so on this projector, I'm just going to put up those results and what we're going to do, and leave it there, at least for a while. Okay, so most of this is what I've just said. Okay, so this is what we're going to do, right? I'm just going to show you by a relatively elementary argument that you can show that the minimal speeds converge as epsilon tends to zero. Right? Now, okay, there are a couple of things to say here. One is that when we're doing this, it will become very clear that C epsilon star is not necessarily equal to C epsilon, right? So it makes it very obvious that you do have to consider waves of different speed if you want to approximate a solution of a hyperbolic problem by solutions of a parabolic problem. The other thing is that the wave of minimal speed is physically the most important one, right? Or it's typically the most stable one. So in Komogorov and Pistinov's paper, they show that if you have a step function as initial data, then you get convergence to the wave of minimal speed in something. And in the paper where, in quite a weak sense actually, but in some sense. And in Corrado's paper where he proves existence of travelling fronts for the hyperbolic problem, he proves a similar result. If you have step function initial data, then you get convergence to the wave of minimum speed. Now if you flip everything and have a positive source term, then this roughly gives you that if you have initial data of compact support, then it will spread in both directions at the minimal wave speed. Right? And this has been known for a long time and certainly was discussed by Anton and Weinberg in the late 70s and early 80s. Okay, so this is some motivation for why we care about the minimal speed. Right? The ones of higher speed are stable in some sense, but typically in an exponentially weighted norm, which means that you basically have to have initial data that converges at exactly the same rate or exactly the same exponential rate as the wave, and then it will converge to one of the waves of higher speed, right? But the largest class of initial data converges in some sense to the wave of minimum speed. Typically not uniformly, actually, but just converge. Okay, so now I'm going to give you some idea of how you go about proving this. And the ideas are not very difficult. It's not a high-tech talk. Okay, so the easy case, maybe this is not a very good way of saying it, is when f is more or less convex. But actually what I mean is that the supremum of f prime is attained when s is 1. Okay, so that certainly is the case if f is convex, but it could also be quite non-convex. Right, but you still have the largest value of the gradient at this point. Okay. Now, what does this tell us? Well, okay. First of all, note that this red inequality always holds. Right? This is just properties of functions. I mean, this is what I observed before, that this number, which is the minimal wave speed for the hyperbolic problem, is less than or equal to the number above which you get smooth solution. Right? And that's the mean value theorem. But then this supremum is certainly bigger than or equal to f prime. Right? Because that's the limit of instance one of this ratio. Right? So basically, the problem that we're talking, the first case we're talking about is when both of these are equal. Right? And actually, the other case I'm going to talk about is when they're not, when they're both not equal. And if this one is equal, this one must be equal, so I'm slightly skipping over one case. But that's just because it would give me something else. It would take too long. Right? Or be a bit complicated. Right? But the case I'm skipping is not really, it's not a problem. Okay, so the problem, the case I'm talking about, first of all, is where you have equality in both of these. Right? In particular, you have equality here, which means that if you look at fronts for the hyperbolic problem, they're smooth. Okay. Okay, so the first thing you might think of doing is proving an upper bound using the formula that you get in the parabolic case. Right? You just need some suitable, nice function rho that you can plug in. Okay, but because we chose C star to be equal to the supremum of F prime here, these H fronts are smooth enough and they work. Right? You plug them into the variational formula for the parabolic problem. Okay, so C epsilon is this infimum, it's less than this object, but this C star plus delta. Is equal to, well, the bits I've got here, g phi over minus phi prime plus f prime of phi, just because I've chosen phi to satisfy this equation here. Okay, so phi is a solution of a hyperbolic problem with some speed slightly bigger than c star. Okay, I plug it in, this converges to c star plus delta as epsilon tends to zero, delta was arbitrary, that therefore tells me that the limit is less than equal to c star. Okay, and in the other case, which I'll do in a moment, you do the same thing, but you have to work harder to find it. Okay, so again, still in the easy case. To finish off proving that C epsilon star converges to C star, it's enough with what was just shown to show that C epsilon star is bigger than C star for every positive epsilon. Okay, so in this case, remember that we had f prime of 1 equal to the supremum of So we had f prime of 1 is equal to c star is equal to the supremum of f prime. So in that case, it's enough just to use basic necessary condition for the existence of the solution of the parabolic problem, which converges to the equilibrium at 1. Okay, so this is the hyperbolic equilibrium. So a necessary condition is the existence of a suitable negative eigenvalue, and that basically means that you need a solution of this quadratic equation. Okay, so you write the linear parabolic problem as a system, you look for eigenvalues, you get a linear, or not a linear, a quadratic equation in lambda. Okay, and I want a negative solution for this, and this will be true when C is sufficiently large. Okay, this will be true when C is sufficiently large, and this amounts the same if I just analyze this basic equation. The C epsilon is bigger than this. Right? But because we're in this easy case, we chose that f prime of 1 was actually equal to c star. Right? C star, remember, was the minimal speed in the hyperbolic problem. Okay, so this gives us what we want. Right? It says that c epsilon star is bigger than or equal to c star plus something positive. Okay, and this also gives you an example where it's definitely the case that the speed depends on epsilon. Right? right? It means the epsilon star is bounded away from C epsilon, sorry, from C star. And we come back to this later, actually, in a slight application at the end. Okay, so now let's look at the different kinds of flux. Okay, so let's focus on the fact that we're taking C star to be strictly less than this diffusion. Right? So basically we have a gap in between and we have some of these fronts with some shocks in them. Okay, and I'm just going to focus on the case just for a slightly technical reason that I have two inequalities. Right? Okay, so the case that I'm skipping is that when this is inequality, this is strictly less than and this is equal. But then I just have to treat it. Okay. So I'm supposing that this f prime of 1 is strictly bigger than this number. Okay, so this number is the biggest value that the slope passing through 1 and f of 1 can take as I basically move it down, as I move this point through the different points of the flux. Okay. So now, because I have this gap, I can't use, basically, if I take some number slightly bigger than C star, I can't take a solution of the hyperbolic problem and plug it into the parabolic thing. Right? I mean, in this formula, I need smooth functions, and it's definitely not clear how you would approximate this solution with shocks in such a way that you got that this ratio was well behaved. So we need to do something else. Okay, so what we do is it basically seems like a trick. And whether there is some physical reason why it works, I don't really understand. Okay, so this is what we do. So first of all, we prove that this limit is less than C star, again using this formula, right? And we need something else. Okay, so we're going to use solutions of the sourceless problem. And now I need to just put up this technical thing. Okay, so there are well-known or well-established conditions for the existence of what are sometimes called viscous shock profiles. Okay, so this is I'm basically going to use this as a tool. Right. Okay, so here is the corresponding equation with no G. Right. Okay, so a necessary and sufficient condition for the existence of a travelling wave, a travelling front, connecting two numbers alpha and beta increasing is that if I look at the flux curve, then the lines between them, between alpha, f of alpha, and beta, f of alpha, lie strictly below the curve. Right? And this is very similar to the argument that I sort of sketched a few minutes ago for the existence of strictly monotonic fronts in the hyperbolic case where you have sufficiently large speed. Okay, so this is without the G term, you get a distance when you have this chord line directly below the curve, and the speed is given by the slope. Right? The speed is given by the slope for every epsilon. Right? So that's what I said earlier, that when you have no source term, you would expect that the speed is uniquely determined. Once you introduce the source term, that's no longer the case. Okay, so you have that the speed is the slope, and you also, just by change of variables, have a scaling, right, with the coefficient in the parabolic equation, that if you take the solution with an epsilon, then this is equal to the solution is epsilon equal to 1, like xi over epsilon. Okay, and in fact, we're going to use fronts for equations of this type to do both parts of the estimate in this case. Okay, so what do we do for this one? Well, for this one, we want some smooth solution connecting 0 to 1. And we sort of do a trick. Right? We introduce a new flux function. We introduce a new flux function that basically connects the points that we want it to connect. Right? So we want a solution, a smooth solution, which has velocity c star plus delta. And remember that C star was the maximal value that this slope can take as you move through points of the flux curve. So you just add on a little bit, move it down, and then move it down a little bit, and then you basically want a flux, which roughly looks pretty much like the flux you already had, but doesn't mess you up when it joins the flux you already had to the point down there. Okay, so let me just say exactly what you do. If you take this slope, which is slightly bigger than C star, right? You take the flux that you had before, but you modify it just in the last part so that it connects to the point that you're interested, that you wanted to connect. Right? Now you can see that in both of those pictures, this lies below the new flux curve. Right? And we can do this in such a way that clearly modify the flux. The derivative is always bigger than it was before. Right? Again, this is for a technical reason, but whether it actually means something for the math. Okay, so here you can see the flux here, the derivative is bigger, and it's going further down, so it's not unreasonable to think that you can construct it so the derivative is always bigger. Okay, so that's what we do, and then we just use solutions of this problem with no source term with this new flux, which exists by this chord condition. And then you plug it in and it works. Right? I mean, this is a variation of formula. It's less than or equal to this guy. You get this because it satisfies this new equation. Okay. You have this thing, which is just sitting there. And then you have this, but you've controlled the sign of it. Right? It's either zero or positive. Okay, so you throw that away, you get an inequality, you pull the epsilon out, and then you have this. Here I've changed xi epsilon to xi 1 because of the scaling, right? And it turns out that this object, you just have to check that this is finite, right? Which it is because of the equation that xi 1 satisfies. And then that attends to this guy as epsilon tends to 0 and we're done. Okay, so this is how it works. Why it works, okay. And then there's the other case. In the other case, we really use quite a different kind of argument, but again, we use solutions of the reactionless equation, or the sources equation. So again, we want to show that C epsilon star is bigger than C star. And here we suppose that it's not true. And this is the first time that we really want to use a comparison theorem for the parallel problem. Okay, so what do? We suppose that it's not true, that C epsilon star is less than C. And then we look for a travelling profile with speed bigger than C epsilon star, such that the profile lies above the parabolic profile with minimal speed, and such that if I set B of X and P to be this travelling profile, then it is a super solution for the parabolic problem. Right? So let's suppose for a moment that I can do all those things. Then, by the comparison theorem for the parabolic problem, this travelling profile will be bigger than this one for all x and t. Right? Because So basically this will give me that the initial data is ordered, right? And everything is bounded, basically. So then an application of the maximum principle to the difference of the solution and this super solution gives me that I have this ordering for all time. But this contradicts the fact that this speed is bigger than this speed, right? Because this guy is going to overtake this. Okay, and then it just remains to show how we find the solution theta epsilon. And for this, we do another trick with an equation with no source term. Okay, so we take, and here I'm also going to skip a case, but just for simplicity, I'm going to take some S star to be the point at which this C-star is attained. Right? So in this picture, it's here. And for simplicity, I've been supposed that it's positive. If it's zero, I just have to bring it in. Okay, so again, by the slide I just showed, there will be a solution of this sourceless equation, which converges to 1 and F star, x identity plus minus b. Right, exists by this chord condition, as we had before. And for simplicity, we'll just suppose that psi with S star is positive. Okay, so why is that a good choice? Well, it's a good choice because we have a sign on G. Right, so if you take a solution of the sourceless equation and you plug it in, then because you know that G is negative, this guy is zero, this is negative, this is positive, so I get a substitution. Okay. So I have a super solution, and what else did I want to know? Yes. I didn't need this later. Yeah. Here I'm choosing the speed of the super solution to be C star, which I suppose for the contradiction argument to be bigger than C star. So epsilon. So all that it remains to do is to check that I can fit one profile above the other one. Right? Now because I'm just considering the easy case when S star is positive, I have no problem at minus infinity. Right? Because this guy tending to be positive, this guy is tending to come tending to zero. So I can just translate them so that the one that's tending to the bigger thing is bigger than the other one. At plus infinity, I need to check the rates of conversion. Right, they both tend exponentially, but if I check the rates of convergence, which I can do, but I won't do right now, then I find that the rate of convergence for the hyperbolic problem is a more negative number, or maybe you want to say it's bigger, but anyway. I mean, it converges more rapidly to the equilibrium at 1 than either solution of the parabolic problem. And that tells me that I can fit it above. And so, I end up with these profiles. This one's moving faster than this one, which contradicts the comparison from the pattern. Okay, so that's pretty much it on the proof. I just wanted to finish by saying sort of something slightly different, which is a consequence of this for parabolic funds. Okay, so if you have parabolic fronts, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking about the easy case, there's this necessary condition that if you have convergence to one, then you need a certain eigenvalue to be present. Right? So this basically means that you have a lower bound on the speed. Right? That C epsilon star is bigger than or equal to what you might, what I'm going to call CL actually, right? So it's basically the minimal velocity for which the linear problem at 1 has an eigenvalue. Right? And we would like to know whether or not this minimal velocity C epsilon star is strictly bigger or equal, right? So why do we want to know? Well, partly because, as I said before, the one of minimal speed is more stable, so in some sense it's most interesting. And typically CL epsilon is just a solution of an algebraic problem, right? So it's much easier to calculate than this number, which comes from the variation formulation. So if you have some conditions which guarantee that they're the same, then you can just calculate this guy, right? The other reason that you'd want to know whether they're equal or not equal is that, so I kind of glossed over this, but there are different types of stability result for the minimal speed front depending on whether or not you have equality or inequality, right? Because when you have equality, in fact, although you get convergence, you only get convergence in sometimes people call it in form. So basically you sort of track a given point, you move them to the same place, and then you have some kind of convergence. In some sense, the solution always lags behind the front a little bit in this case. But if you happen to have a strict inequality there, And sorry, so the equality case is basically the critical one, where at the minimal case you have exactly one, where you have a repeated root, right, for the eigenvalue problem. But if you have the C absolute star is strictly bigger than the linearized speed, then at the minimal speed C absolute star, you have two eigenvalues. And that means that you can, well, basically you have better spectral properties. You can change into an exponentially weighted norm where you take the weight to be e to the lambda x, where lambda is in there, and in fact you get uniform convergence in that case. Right? So it's not just that you want to know the minimal wave speed, it's also that qualitatively the types of stability results that you get depend on whether or not you're in this case where basically it's sort of borderline from a spectral point of view, or you're in this case where you have better convergence results. Yeah.
Is that like a phase? In the first case, is that like a shift in phase then? You converge to the right profile, but there's a shift in phase.
And it always lags behind.
And in the other case, it catches up.
Yes.
So you get
it converges in a uniform norm. In fact, it converges in 1 plus e to the lambda x or something. I mean, it converges very well in this case. But in this case, it doesn't converge uniformly. And I mean, this particular thing, people have, I mean, certainly KPP, and then there were probabilistic work by Branson, who worked very hard to work out exactly in what way it converges. So this is just sort of a brief catalogue of some types of result that guarantee either equality or inequality. And by far the most famous one, I think, is, I think it was originally Hasler and Rothman in 75. And this also is basically what the KPP nonlinearity is, but it would be the other way up, right? But it says that the nonlinearity lies strictly above the tangent at 1, right? So this is the case where you have zero flux, your source term lies above the tangent at the unstable 0, right? And that's enough to prove equality. I'm not going to go into why. More recently, now this is sort of a folklore thing when it was difficult to find a reference, but I think sort of basically in combustion theory in the early 80s, there were some sort of integral-type conditions that guaranteed inequality. This again is in the case of zero flux and something of this form on the source. And then there's much more recent work on systems by Weinberger, Lewis, and Lee, who again have zero flux and various conditions on systems, who give conditions for equality. And they were motivated by specific biological applications. Okay, so conditions with non-zero flux, there's some recent work by Ben-Gurion, DePatie, and Mendes in Physical Review E, where they have some condition like this. Right, which is G here is the source term and X the flux term, and you want that this inequality holds for all U in 0, 1. And then there's a whole slew of work, basically, by Heinze and other people on slightly different problems, but I feel I should mention it anyway, where you have a linear term involved in the gradient, and you have an effect that the minimal speed is enhanced by the presence of this gradient term. And there's a whole series of papers, with this the most recent one, where you could look at the behavior of the C epsilon star on M, which is the coefficient in this term. Okay, so I'm just going to make a small remark, which is that here we have this CL epsilon, we calculated it, I don't know, 10 slides ago, as being F prime plus twice the square root of epsilon G prime of 1. Okay, this is the minimal speed for which there exists a negative eigenvalue. And this clearly converges to F prime 1 as epsilon tends to 0, right? Whereas C epsilon star, we showed, always converges to C star, which is this guy, right? So if this is bigger than this, then this tells us that we have inequality for small epsilon, right? For any G, satisfying the hypothesis that we have, right? Okay, so this is another condition to add to the list, but I mean, some of the rest of it, I think, is sort of interesting from a theoretical point of view, but this is really of practical, well, I think it's probably of less theoretical interest, but its interest is more practical, right? And so it would be nice to know that there's an application where this actually tells us, because it's from a practical point of view that we really care whether C epsilon and star is equal to C L epsilon. Okay, that's all I want to say.